support comes from Ohio State's Ross Heart Hospital, whose wellness series continues for 2014. The second annual Ross Heart Hospital 5K Walk and Run takes place February 8th at Easton Town Center. Details on this 5K and the entire wellness series are at rosswellnessseries.org.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. People everywhere are mourning the death of apartheid revolutionary Nelson Mandela, a man whose work in his own country inspired millions across the world. Among them were thousands of students at American universities in the 1980s, distressed by their school's support for corporations with ties to South Africa.
You couldn't miss them, the growing core of activists, organized, vocal, and committed to making UVM's Board of Trustees change its mind and sell off investments in companies doing business in South Africa. One of their targets, UVM President Laddie Kaur, about 75 students staging a sit-in and meeting inside Kaur's office. The president wasn't there, but students moved in anyway. The students drew up a list of demands, namely that trustees totally divest within 6 months.
That was sound from the University of Vermont, which divested completely in 1985. Ohio State soon followed suit. Michael Cord was instrumental in OSU's vote to cut corporate ties with South Africa. He joins us now from Philadelphia, where he is a lawyer, activist, and OSU law school grad. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Michael, you were at OSU Law School in the 80s, and you were active in the group Students United Against Apartheid. And you drafted a letter in 1985 asking the university to divest. How did you first get involved in the movement in the first place?
Great question. At the time, I was the president of the Black Law Students Association, and we had all heard about what was going on, obviously, in South Africa. We all knew about apartheid. We knew about something called the Sullivan Principles. I'll get into that later. But one of the things I think that really catapulted us to doing what we did, there was talk in South Africa, and obviously it got international notoriety, where they were talking about the people in South Africa, the Nationalist Party, expanding an already horrendously racist constitution by doing more damage to black folks. People should know that the beginning of all this was in 1948 when the Nationalist Party came to power, and they pretty much made official what had already been going on. So for me, hearing about the Sullivan Principles, hearing about an expansion of the racism in the 80s in the South African Constitution, I felt that as a law student, specifically as a black law student, we ought to do something about that, considering what happened here in America in terms of black students and higher education. So I got together with a young lady by the name of Lisa Aubrey, a gentleman by the name of Glenn Caldwell, and several other students, and we formed something called SUA, S-U-A-A, Students United Against Apartheid, and it was a broad-based coalition, and we pushed and pushed and pushed and ultimately won.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Michael Cord. He's an attorney in Philadelphia. He is calling us from Philadelphia today. He was also back in the 80s an activist as an OSU law school student. You drafted a letter, as I mentioned earlier, in 1985 asking Ohio State University to divest in the corporations that did business in South Africa. Can you read from that letter now? And in so doing, you'll explain a little bit about the Sullivan Principles.
Certainly, certainly. This group, Students United Against Apartheid, and the organizers, primarily with Lisa Aubrey and myself, we put together a letter dated February 1, 1985, addressed to the Board of Trustees at Ohio State University with a copy to the president of the university at the time, Edward Jennings. And the letter basically demands that the university divest. And when we say divest, we simply mean stop investing in companies doing business in or with South Africa. Mm-hmm. And in the letter specifically, we say this: the current United States policy of constructive engagement, which asserts that through a business relationship, apartheid will slowly disappear, has been shown to be a failure. Under this policy, thousands of Africans and their supporters have been either arrested, imprisoned, beaten, or even killed. In fact, many international observers have noted that this policy has emboldened the South African government to solidify and thereby increase repression. We go on in the letter to say, like the policy of constructive engagement, the Sullivan principles, which call for workplace-related reforms for Africans in South Africa, have also been shown to be a failure. It should be noted at the outset that these principles were doomed to failure because they ignored the pervasive, ever-present political and societal problem inherent in apartheid. And we go on to say a bit more, but that's essentially the background or the foundation of why we were doing what we were doing.
There were plenty of people opposed to divestment, but there was also pushback from some students. This was not a universally, even though it was a broad-based coalition, not everybody agreed. What were some of the arguments at the time that students used against it, not just the administration?
Certainly. One was what I alluded to, the constructive engagement. Mm-hmm. That was a policy created by the Reagan administration. And the premise of it was this. You know, we're good guys here in the United States. If we work with the bad guys, some of the goodness from us will kind of blend over to them, and we can engage them, we can have dialogue, and we can get things done. If we put them off to the side, then they'll just do their dirt over there without anyone trying to change. So the Reagan administration thought that constructive engagement was the way to deal with them. And there were some students who thought that, hey, that makes sense too. It's better to have everybody at the table than to push them out the door. But that was nonsense. That was a cover for corporations wanting to do continued business with South Africa. On the other end of the spectrum, so many people who were supporting the constructive engagement notion, I guess if I could classify them, many of them might have tended to be Republican and conservative. However, on the other end, the Democratic students, the liberal students, progressive students, there might have been some who opposed it as well in terms of divestment because, and I've heard this argument, hey, you students in SWA, Students United Against Apartheid, if you talk about pulling American companies out, then the few blacks that do have jobs in South Africa are going to lose those jobs. You folks over here in the United States have the convenience of calling for folks to lose their jobs when companies leave, but you're not the one going to be thrown into poverty. We had responses to both. The argument about constructive engagement, we exposed that as a cover for businesses wanting to continue to profit. And in regard to those who say that we're not considering those who would be victimized by companies pulling out, we said this. We weren't leading this battle. We were taking our cue from the ANC, the African National Congress, the leading group in South Africa, as well as the PAC, the Pan-African Congress. So these were the leading organizations in South Africa, and they called for divestment. And they made a great argument. They said, look, yeah, it's true. We're going to lose some jobs. People do have jobs. But the problem is that the whole issue regarding the anti-apartheid movement is not just about jobs. We want an end to this passbook notion, which means black folks got to carry an ID around to be permitted to be anywhere in South Africa. We want to vote. We want to live where we want. We want to worship where we want. We want to go to school where we want. We want to be able to go to hospitals and hotels. We want to do what everybody else does. So this whole notion of constructive engagement, this whole notion of the Sullivan principles, that simply deals with the business component. The life is bigger than that. We want to change the society. So we heard those arguments. They were weak arguments, and that's why ultimately we succeeded in getting Ohio State University, not the first university in the country to divest, but I'd argue probably the most important because it was by far the largest university to divest.
How much did you work with other students at other universities? We listened to a cut earlier on in the show from the University of Vermont. How much did you talk about strategy and that sort of thing?
Great question. We pretty much didn't work directly with any other schools, but we did lean on some of the research. For example, Stanford did some great work, Columbia University, University of Wisconsin, Madison. I think Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts was the first to do it back in 1977. So we did extensive research. We didn't have to reinvent the wheel at Ohio State. We looked at what else was done, and we wanted to use that and make it bigger and better, and we were successful in doing that. And one of the things we wanted to make clear at Ohio State is that even though there were primarily black students at the leadership position of Students United Against Apartheid, it clearly was a broad-based Space Coalition. Black, white, Latino, Asian, male, female, gay, straight. Everybody understood, as the UN said, that apartheid was a crime against humanity. So everybody jumped on board.
As you look back and recall those days, what was your sense about how the Board of Trustees responded and how they treated you as student activists at the time? Because, of course, you know, you're coming off the 60s and the 70s and some really intense student activism. This was different.
You know, I am involved in a number of activist endeavors here in Philadelphia.
So you've kind of, you're still an activist.
Yes, absolutely. And one of the ways that we are effective here, as we did at Ohio State, is we realized that, for example, now I'm an attorney. So what we say is this: we need lawyers to go into the courtrooms to raise issues. We need activists to go into the streets to raise hell. That's what we say today. Well, at Ohio State, we kind of did the same thing because we had regular grassroots, normally apolitical folks showing up at rallies to back us up. Hmm. But at the leadership, we had graduate students. We had law students. In fact, this letter that I just referred to from February 1, 1985, it's one of the few letters I've ever seen that has a selected bibliography at the end. So we weren't just yelling and screaming as angry young activists. We did some great research. And at the outset, the Board of Trustees and the president really didn't take us seriously until they found out who we were. We had the brains and the brawn. So initially, it was kind of antagonistic, but toward the end, we all came together. And I'm not going to say that the university did it because it was the right thing to do, maybe, but I'd argue a stronger argument is they did it because they were kind of forced into doing it. But I always say, I don't care why you do the right thing, as long as you do the right thing.
Well, Michael Cord, thanks so much for joining us today to talk about what your work was as an anti-apartheid activist at Ohio State University in the mid-1980s. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. And by the way, you have a great show. I'm going to make sure that I constantly tune in from Philadelphia. Please keep up the great work.
Thanks, Michael. Coming up, we're going to hear from Julia Lynn Walker, who also was worked against apartheid in the 1980s in the United States and then later traveled to South Africa as an activist. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Today we're remembering the life and leadership of Nelson Mandela, who died last week at the age of 95. And we're also remembering the life and leadership of some of the folks who worked against the apartheid movement in the United States and specifically in Columbus and at Ohio State. For many South Africans, the culmination of all Mandela had worked for came in April of 1994, when that country's black citizens were allowed to vote for the first time ever, as heard here on ABC News.
They had waited a lifetime for this day. A father carried to and from the voting station on his son's back. A mother arrived by wheelbarrow.
Hello. Yeah.
An emotional day for all.
It is very exciting. We are so excited, really. We can't contain ourselves.
Anything can happen to me after this. I don't mind. As long as I've cast my vote.
This day is a very big day for us.
It was in that election that the country elected Nelson Mandela its first black president. And Julia Lynn Walker was there to see it happen. She's a business consultant specializing in the African diaspora, and she joins us now in the studio. Welcome, Julia Lynn Walker.
Thank you very much, Ann.
Why were you in South Africa at the time?
I was fortunate enough to be able to choose to be there. And I was fortunate enough and able to be able to find something productive to do.
So what were you doing?
I was serving as a consultant for diversity management. Let me back up and say that I was fortunate in being able to go prior to the first Democratic election, and I want to emphasize that, in 1994 as part of the pre-election workshop process.
Okay, all right.
So I wasn't there for the actual election, and then I went back in 1997 and stayed for 15 years initially working in diversity management.
Okay, well, that's a big difference in a way, because You were there before it happened. What were your hopes and fears in at the time you were there preparing people to
vote? Well, first of all, of course, I never expected to ever be in South Africa. And I was very...
Born and raised in Columbus?
I was born and raised in Columbus, but I had parents who were very open and that were actually involved in the civil rights movement and, by extension, liberation support activities around the world. And so my mother, for instance, worked with the United Nations at Denison, which was a center for students coming into the United States before they were assigned to other universities. So we had students in our home from South Africa and Southern Africa. And then I actually attended the University of Ghana for my junior year abroad experience in 1969 and met South Africans then who were in exile supported by the Ghanaian government at university. And then I went back from 72 to 75 in Tanzania. And that, of course, was the center of all the liberation movements because Julius Nyerere was the only one who said that any liberation movement could come, be there, establish an office. And so you were able to learn and interact with South Africans, Angolans, Mozambicans, and it was a tremendously exciting opportunity. But to think that we would actually meet again in South Africa was unknown. And to go into South Africa at that time for a person of African descent, you had to go in as an honorary white. And there were African Americans and others from the diaspora who went in. Sidney Poitier went in as part of a film crew, and he refused to accept that status of being an honorary white. But the apartheid government, as Michael said, you know, has been growing steadily in its ability to control social conditions since 1948. So there were a number of structures that had to be dismantled in order for there to be a functioning democratic society.
When you were there for the workshops in
it was 1994,
before the election.
That's correct.
What did people talk about? Even then, did they think that it was really going to happen?
Yes.
Okay. People then it was for sure.
Because there had been over a four-year period from 1990 when he was released to 94, there had been a series of workshops, CODESRA, that represented the negotiation. And people understood, you know, the kinds of things that had to happen. Not only had there been negotiations, but there had been civil strife. There had been insurrections, different communities. And some people who realized that they were perhaps not going to get what they wanted, you know, resorted to violence within the townships. There were some very specific incidents that were very violent and very disruptive and actually very cruel. So it was not a smooth transition by any means. And people were very clear, you know, about what was at stake. And I think that is why, you know, even now, just listening to the excerpt, I think both of us, you know, got a few goosebumps.
Yeah.
Because it was an incredible, you know, commitment to change. And when we look back and see the lines and we understand the different kinds of people, you know, who waited and waited in order to vote, we understand that regardless of how sophisticated or unsophisticated, educated or uneducated, you know, exposed internationally or not, people understood what they were vesting in terms of their country. And we can only respect that.
Nelson Mandela did a lot of the negotiations himself. He was involved in them, was deeply involved in them. He was a lawyer.
Yes.
And a lot of people say because of his background and his scholarly approach to it, it's why it was able to unfold the way it did, even despite the strife and despite the problems that they did have.
What I would like to emphasize, 2 points. Earlier when you said he was the first black president, that's true. But I think what we really need to focus on, that he was the first Democratic president. Hmm. And so the whole country up to then did not function on the basis of democracy. So for white people, it was also a new era in terms of being a democratic country. So they too were needing to understand, to learn what democracy meant. So the negotiations, you know, opened up a level of discussion that simply hadn't existed before. Right. And secondly, yes, he was a lawyer. He was leading the team. He actually initiated or he led the discussions while he was still in prison. And that's a chapter that still needs to be fully discussed. And the information is there, but, you know.
Well, he was imprisoned, but he was in a different place, and they still imprisoned him, and he wasn't at Robin.
No. It's a little more complex than that. What I'm saying is that even though he was in prison, even though he was publicly characterized as a terrorist, there had been discussions between the business community and the ANC, for instance, in Dakar, Senegal. And from those discussions, the leadership began to understand that there had to be a negotiated settlement, all right? And that in order to do that, that they had to involve Nelson Mandela. So the government officials actually went to the prison and had discussions with Mandela. And then as part of that process, Mandela was brought out of prison. And he was actually introduced to society under very controlled conditions so that he would understand what it was that he was involved in, because he'd been in prison for 27 years. And then he gave leadership to this process under the mantra of the ANC. So there was a collective process. And in the negotiations, there were times when Mandela said, I'm not familiar with this, and he turned it over to Cyril Ramaphosa. Or he said, Thabo Mbeki, you know, you really are better placed to be able to address these issues. So he understood where his strengths and his weaknesses lay, and he understood how to ensure that the collective process helped to make a success of the entire process.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Julia Lynn Walker. She worked worked against apartheid in the 1980s and continues to be an activist and also a scholar of the African diaspora. When you left after that workshop phase in 1994, was it hard to leave? Didn't you want to be there?
I did. And that's why a few years later, when I finished that contract in another 3 years, then I made plans to return. And because I had friends and contacts and networks that existed already, I was able to move fairly seamlessly to South Africa and able to then move into an area, you know, that's characterized now as diversity management or diversity and inclusion. And I think that in many respects, for me, that was perhaps the most radical thing I could have done at that time. Because what we were doing was really getting people to talk to each other as human beings. Because people really had such stereotypes, such characterizations about the different groups. They really didn't know, you know, that people were just people and with the same hopes and aspirations and feelings and commitments, but really, you know, just being able to have that dialogue. And for over 5 years, that was my primary, you know, area of focus. And it was a very, you know, emotional process even for me, because you really had to, you know, ensure that people had a safe space in which to talk and that people really then were able to address their very basic, you know, concerns, hopes, loves, and fears, and that those hopes, loves, and fears were then respected, and that then people could then build on them later constructively. And we said that it's not just about, you know, a feel-good process. It's really about, you know, institution building, taking these individuals and saying, what does that mean in terms now of making sure that there are functional institutions in this new society?
Who did you work with? Who did you work for?
I worked for different consulting firms, two consulting firms primarily, but we worked with government units, we worked with corporations, we worked with NGOs, and we worked with people throughout the country. I was very fortunate in being able to work in all 9 provinces. We worked with all the ethnicities, you know, now generally characterized as white, but white breaks down as Afrikaner, Boer, and English-speaking primarily, but there are other groups. And then the Africans, and again, a number of different ethnicities that are traditional to South Africa. And then the group that's regarded as colored, which is really a mixed group. And then they primarily speak Afrikaans. Their home base is the Western Cape, but they live all over the country.
I remember I didn't meet a South African until I was at a journalism conference, mm-hmm. and got to know this guy. He was white South African, and mm-hmm. he was a journalist. And when we parted, a lot of us said, what do you need? Because he had talked about how isolated the country was and how isolated they were from a lot of things we took for granted in the United States and around the world even. And he said books. Books were one of the hardest things to get in South Africa.
Sure.
Even then, when it was open.
Absolutely. And in many cases, when we were engaged in discussions and, you know, and I would say, well, okay, let's step back, because we can't assume that people know our history, meaning people who come from outside South Africa, when in many respects they don't know their own history. And that's how, you know, deforming the apartheid government had been in terms of really undermining and I really, you know, want to emphasize that very often people see it as a way in which Africans were undermined, but all South Africans, black, white, colored, it doesn't Indian, it doesn't matter, all South Africans were undermined and deformed by the apartheid government.
What in particular inspired you to work on divestment efforts when you got back to the United States in the 1970s? And I'm talking specifically about the boycott of the Krugerrand coin and that kind of thing.
Well, it was a continuation of the experiences and lessons that I had learned from my South African friends in Ghana and Tanzania. And I was also in law school. I attended Northwestern University School of Law.
Bravo.
Exactly. You know, and there was a very strong divestment process there. So it was just a natural way to continue the work that I was doing. And it was very interesting, you know, returning to South Africa later in 1997, because I realized that there's an extremely large or growing group of repatriates. And these are African-Americans or other people of African descent, say from the Caribbean or from Europe, who are now living in South Africa. And many of them had their roots in the anti-apartheid movement in Europe or the U.S., even Canada. And they've returned to South Africa to work and live, because many, you know, experience some of the questions that are coming up now in terms of, okay, what next? Now that apartheid is ended, now that we have a democratic dispensation, is the world a better place and we can all sleep soundly at night? And of course, the answer is no. And so many people understood that it was now about a social struggle. It was about an economic struggle. It was about a political struggle that ensured that, you know, many of the ideas of Mandela are actually maintained.
The movie Invictus depicted Nelson Mandela quite prominently, obviously. It was about the South African national rugby team and how it, at least for a day, united the country.
Right.
How united does the country feel now to you?
How united does the country feel?
It seemed to be important to Mandela, at least in that story.
Yes. Let me back up a bit. And I think that what Mandela was able to do very successfully is walk that tightrope between tactics and strategy. And sometimes people looked at that incident with the rugby match and thought that that was strategy. That was really a tactic. It was a symbolic moment to say, you know, we can come together in this way. But tactically, in order to maintain that unity, there are some other fundamental things that we have to do. We have to let go of, or we have to adopt. And so that process really has been short-circuited in certain respects. And right now, I don't know if you were able to get up at 4 o'clock this morning and I know.
I was tossing and turning, preparing for our interview.
For this, right. But when the current president, Jacob Zuma, came on, he was actually booed several times by
that.
The audience. And I think that booing really represented what people saw and as, you know, his inability to adopt, to be able to live, to be able to lead the country as successfully as Thabo Mbeki did or Mandela. Not in the same way, you know, not following the same, but in a principled manner in his own way. And I think that in many respects, some of the comments, you know, were that, well, what is he going to say? And is he going to be able to say it, you know, in a cogent manner? Because people really aren't clear on what it is he believes, because he'll say one thing or he'll, you know, adopt the cloak of the ANC, but then some of his actions speak quite differently. So when you say, is the country united? No, the country's not united. There's some very serious issues in terms of the extreme economic inequalities that exist that should have been minimized but haven't because of some of the policies that the government has taken. There's some issues in terms of how people have still been able to retain privilege and to benefit from privilege, even though there's supposed to be a democratic, you know, dispensation. So there's still a lot of grappling around how to make it work that's going on that stops it from being a fully unified nation.
When did you first hear about Nelson Mandela?
Oh, it's very hard to say. I'm sure it would have been sometime between 12 and 15, mm-hmm. Because that was the kind of discussion that took place in our home. And I know that and we were interacting with people who were, you know, as I mentioned, at Denison, and we had dinners in our home and there were discussions. So I'm sure that was the period when I really understood and heard.
Now, you never met him.
I was in the room.
And you were in the room, though.
Yes, and I was very fortunate. There were two or three occasions. Number one, I was privileged to have been invited as an activist to a meeting in New York in 1990 when he was released. And I think that one of the fascinating things about Mandela is that people always underestimate the response. And I think even in a room of activists and when we're seasoned people, we understand what's happened, there was still such an incredible crush. And even the whole schedule was delayed because there was just this constant.
Everywhere he went.
Exactly. So even in that meeting, it was cut short. And then I helped to build the constituencies that attended in Washington, D.C. and Atlanta. But when I was in South Africa, I worked with the Nelson Mandela's Children's Fund. That's one of the three legacy projects that the family recognizes. And as part of that process, was part of the board meeting. Well, at that level, you know, you don't get up and start taking pictures or, you know, just it's a different scene.
You're too cool to do that.
Well, it's just it's everybody right, in the room. Right. You just don't do that.
You're not a tourist.
Exactly. You stand up, you present your report, you get your comments, you sit down, and that's it. You don't really. And the other thing is that in the last years of his life, his eyes were actually quite bad. And even in a public venue, people were requested not to take pictures because the flash was an irritant. So it was really quite strictly adhered to that not happened. So it really, it was just a different scene.
What was his, was he like he always appears to be like to the public, sort of this serene, father-like?
Serene, father-like, yes, but it was more than that.
Okay.
For me, it was a question of astuteness. He seemed to be able to capture, you know, the sense of the moment, or he was able to identify the contradiction and to be able to and then address it in a way that cleared the path so that people could move forward, you know, in a discussion or understood, you know, what a particular issue represented, you know, strategically. And so for me, that was, you know, what I glimpsed and really began to appreciate. But, you know, there was this fundamental charisma that even he would, even when he was, you know, frail and at the end, he would just walk very slow. And you knew, you know, and people would just start dancing and joking as a way to give him space to make his way, because it would take him some time to actually cross a room. But then he would just stop and you knew he was resting and he would just smile and you just were included. And I thought that was a fantastic thing.
My guest is Julia Lynn Walker. She worked on the anti-apartheid movement in the 1980s. She's a scholar now of the African diaspora. If you have a question or comment for her, she's going to stay with us for the next segment. So give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Columbus native Julia Lynn Walker. In the 1970s and 80s, pretty much her whole life, I have come to learn, worked against the apartheid regime in South Africa, and is an African diaspora scholar now. If you have a question or comment for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You mentioned, Julia Lynn, that you went on to work for the Nelson Mandela Children's Fund, which was Mandela founded. What is their mission? What did you do?
The Nelson Mandela Children's Fund was established specifically as the activist arm of his legacy. And the fund looks at ways in which to improve the condition of children, not just in South Africa, but Southern Africa and in part worldwide. And so it raises funds, it solicits proposals, and because of what was happening in South Africa at the time, which was the pandemic of HIV and AIDS, a large focus was looking at how to ameliorate the situation of children with HIV and AIDS. And it wasn't just about the medical issues, because actually what they've moved on to do is they've started to establish the Nelson Mandela Children's Hospital coming out of this work. But it was also about looking at the social needs of children. And I think it was very important because people didn't understand that as, you know, the medicines improved and the ARVs have improved, then you're looking at children who are either born or acquired it, you know, later, who are then going to have a lifespan of 20, 30 years. And but they're living with the disease. So how do you manage and live positively with the disease? So they really began the first programs that began to look at children entering their teens and having discussions through clubs about, you know, what they can do as they began to explore their sexuality, as any teen would do. And so they've really have made some inroads in terms of children's health and welfare generally.
Do you go back to Africa much now?
I try my best.
How often do you?
I was in 2013. I was there twice. I actually took a group from Ohio State for a study tour to Ghana in May, and then I went back to Cape Town in July as part of an academic conference hosted by a program in Cape Town.
How much has it changed over the years?
It's changed tremendously. But physically, areas of the country that previously weren't accessible to all citizens of South Africa are accessible if people are economically, you know, capable of accessing those resources. Educational process has opened up. And even where the conditions perhaps haven't improved within the township, children get up quite early, 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning, and they travel significant distances to be able to go to a school that would provide for them, you know, appropriately. There's now what's called the generation of the born frees. And these are the children who've born since 1994. And people are tracking them to say, well, how is their experience different? And for many of them, all they know is an integrated culture to a certain extent. And it's a good on one hand, it's positive. On the other hand, many of the lessons of the recent South African history, you know, are not explored because many teachers and parents say, you know, they don't want to make the children uncomfortable. They want them to move forward on a positive note. And therefore, let's not focus on the past. Let's just focus on the future.
Gosh, that decision's been made in a lot of countries over the ages. What do you make of that?
Well, we see a similar situation in the United States, and I think that sometimes we, you know, have to reaffirm within the African American community that those who have made progress, and certainly President Obama does it, you know, have to recognize that they stand on the shoulders of those who came before. That many people have opened the door, laid the groundwork to ensure that people who are successful are.
We have an email from Veronica. She asks, does your guest remember the popular musician's boycott of Sun City?
Absolutely.
She said maybe she could talk for a few seconds about Sun City. Today's college students wouldn't remember. This was a pop rap song called Sun City by the United by Artists United Against Apartheid. Tell us, that sounds anti... it doesn't sound like you would be opposed to it.
No. Okay, maybe I missed. Let me just respond, and then if I misunderstood, you can correct me. But as Michael identified earlier, there were a number of different strands for the anti-apartheid movement.
Okay,
and so there was a sports boycott. And some of you may remember in Mexico City when Carlos Russell and the three of the brothers stood on the they gave the Black Power salute. So sports was a way to fight against apartheid, and then music was a way. And so many entertainers refused to play Sun City because that was an enclave that the apartheid government had established in an area called Batutatswana. And so Sun City was supposed to be an independent, this was part of the homeland myth. South Africa said, oh, no, these are independent countries. They just happen to be part of us, but they have their own government. And therefore, you know, you can relate to them the same as you relate to Ghana or Nigeria. But they weren't independent. They were complete puppets of the apartheid government. So Sun City was built up as this arena. This is Las Vegas. And so international entertainers came in because the Afrikaners, the white people of South Africa, they wanted access to this international entertainment. But people would not go into South Africa itself proper. So everybody went into Sun City. And they, so when you say, I'm not going to play Sun City, that's what people with the musicians were saying is, I won't go and support the apartheid government by giving access to this international culture in this phony homeland situation.
But some people did. Did they just not realize it? Were they duped?
No. Some people, I don't want to, you know, but some people did. And they said they were apolitical. They wanted the money. And they weren't concerned about where it came from. They weren't involved in politics.
Blacks?
Absolutely. And, you know, Tina Turner played there. I mean, there's a whole list of musicians that played there. So and so that was part of the boycott when people came back. Then the anti-apartheid movement said, well, we have to talk to them. We have to not play their records or we have to not support their shows because they did this. And then sometimes it was successful, sometimes it wasn't. But there was a very strong group of musicians beginning from the mid-60s who supported the process. And the ANC actually had an ANC choir, for instance, that went around the world raising funds, singing songs, and ensuring that the message got out. So there was a pro and a con process to the cultural component of the anti-apartheid movement.
You mentioned Sidney Poitier. Was that
yes,
who you mentioned?
Yes,
who would not take on the mantle of honorary white?
That's correct.
Who are some of the other leaders in the entertainment industry that opposed Sun City? That was it? Anybody?
Well, we have to start with the greats. Harry Belafonte,
yes.
Just without a doubt, is the dean
of activist entertainers.
Absolutely,
yeah.
And he, you know, gave political direction. He gave economic support. In terms of his career, he made career decisions based on, you know, his political sense. Some people are some that you may not be familiar with. CCH Pounder. She's an actress. You'll recognize her, you know, if you mm-hmm. see her. She was a staff person that really, you know, and sometimes we forget the people who, you know, played an organizational role in ensuring that, you know, this process was taken forward. You know, and certainly Sidney Poitier, you know, continued to play a role. You know, earlier I asked you if you were familiar with Miriam Makeba, because she was a musician, really the diva, the original diva from South Africa. And she came as part of a film called King Kong. She left South Africa to play a role in this film, which is a story about a South African situation. But then she stayed. And she married a man named Hugh Masekela, who was also a musician, played the trumpet. And together, they were very significant in terms of promoting, you know, the discussion around South Africa. And Miriam Makeba was actually the first South African, male or female, to address the United Nations on the issue of apartheid. And so in 61, and so there's a snippet, there's a, on
in
you can Google.
In 1961?
61, 62, but, okay. but you can Google. And there's a snippet of her appearing at the United Nations. And it's an incredible moment. But she basically lost her passport, and she could not go back. She was not allowed to go back to bury her mother. She stayed out for, you know, maybe 30-some years. She later married Stokely Carmichael and lived in Guinea in West Africa.
Okay.
But all along, she was very consistent in promoting, you know, the liberation of South Africa. And it really was at the cost to her career in some respects.
We talked, you know, earlier with Michael Cord, who was an OSU law student back in the 80s when he worked to end OSU investments in companies that did business in South Africa or with South Africa. When did you feel like in Ohio or in Central Ohio, at least, the lights started to go on for people about this issue?
The 80s. I think across
with the divestment.
Absolutely.
Movement?
And it wasn't just a student movement.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember, it was also about public funds. It was about the pension funds.
The legislature.
The unions, mm-hmm. Absolutely. So the unions were involved, municipalities were involved, the universities were involved, corporations were involved. You had shareholders, you know, buying one stock and going to the shareholder meetings and raising the issues. So it really was across the board. And people, you know, if they didn't know, they had to learn something and at least make a decision pro or con.
They finally had something that they could do about it.
Yes, and you know, as Michael referenced, the discussion, you know, in terms of our government with Reagan and the issues around constructive engagement, and people were like, no. I mean, and there was very, you know, vociferous discussion, you know, where people were challenging their legislatures. And I remember, you know, again, there were different sit-ins, or we had a process where we just lined up people. And so any given week, you went in and we just had people go in consistently asking questions about where do you stand on these issues? And then, of course, the South African embassy, where people would go and then be jailed. And so we had all kinds of people. You had
people would go there to protest and then be jailed.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And we're talking politicians, civil rights leaders, religious leaders. And it began, innocuously enough as just another protest. But then the symbolism of it began to grow. And at the end, there were several thousand people who were actually jailed by demonstrating at the South African embassy. So or arrested. And there were different issues around whether people went to jail or paid a fine. But that process brought attention, and they took that attention back to their, you know, home constituencies. So there was this whole cadre of people who were veterans of the South African embassy protests, and that became a different badge of honor.
As you took the words right out of my mouth. How much was the anti-apartheid movement in the United States and maybe elsewhere eclipsed by the civil rights movement in the United States during those years? If at all, maybe eclipsed is the wrong word, but
yes.
How would you describe it?
I would say that they were complementary.
Okay.
And each one, you know, had its had a time when it was ascendant. But they were complementary in that as people learned more about South Africa, they also began to understand, well, how much better are we functioning here? We have the laws, but have we actually changed the attitudes? So how long does it take to change attitudes? And what kinds of things do we have to do, you know, to make sure that those changes occur?
So I guess then how does the civil rights movement and the successes or failures of it inform the South African
exactly.
civil rights movement?
And it wasn't just those two, because I think we also have to look at the issues around the anti-war struggle and what that meant in terms of issues of power. We looked at gender discussions, you know, and now we look at the question of differing identities, you know, whatever that means in terms of a sexuality continuum. So I think that all of those struggles inform, contribute to, support, and or raise contradictions, you know, with each other. But it's part of a process that then says, at the end of the day, how does this help to make our society as a whole, and really as a global society, you know, a better one?
Well, Julia Lynn Walker, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Anne, for inviting me.
Julia Lynn Walker was an anti-apartheid activist in the 1980s. She's a native of Columbus and lives here now, and she's a scholar of the African diaspora. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.